Welcome to the second episode in our new series on climate change. For those of you who don't already know me, I'm Nicole Asquith, host of In the Weeds, where we look at the many ways in which culture shapes the natural world. Climate change being perhaps the most obvious example of this intersection. For the second installment in this series, I'm excited to present a conversation I had with David Biello, author of The Unnatural World. David Biello is science curator for TED Talks and an award-winning journalist who has been reporting on the environment and energy for over 20 years. As he puts it, long enough to be cynical, but not long enough to be depressed. If you'd like to know more, not just about how messed up the world is, but also how we might be able to turn things around, how we might gulp, even make things better, then his book is a great resource. It's just chock full of fascinating stories and information. All right, here we go. So I was going to start at the beginning, but as I was waiting to talk to you, I was looking up about woolly mammoths.
Oh, yes.
So you write about these efforts toward de-extinction.
Yes.
Notably of the passenger pigeon. Since your book was published, there has been more news on the woolly mammoth in particular. I believe a company has been formed with the express goal of bringing back to life at least some version of the woolly mammoth.
The company is called Colossal, and it's a co-production of George Church, who I talk about in the book, and some funders and investors. And the idea, as you laid out there, is to bring back some version of the woolly mammoth by essentially editing the genome of an Asian elephant, which is the closest living relative of the woolly mammoth. And, you know, turning on the genes for more hair, bigger bulk, various other things, or inserting those genes from other animals. The signal improvement in Colossal's plan versus the plans that I had seen in the past is, and this may be also the most out there aspect of the plan, instead of gene editing a baby Asian elephant into a mammoth and having a regular mother Asian elephant carry that baby to term and then having the woolly mammoth kind of be born from an Asian elephant, their goal now is to essentially build an artificial womb that will somehow be able to incorporate a 200-pound baby and grow it to that size and produce these woolly mammoths. So it's a pretty colossal undertaking, if I can make that pun. And there are a lot of things that don't exist yet, particularly that artificial womb. That's even more out there than the idea of gene editing Asian elephants to turn them into woolly mammoths. Now, the goal behind all this, lest you think that they're just insane.
Having fun.
Yeah,
just having on steroids.
Fun. Yes, exactly. The goal is that woolly mammoths, when they were around, were responsible for kind of creating the mammoth steppe, these vast grasslands in Siberia and elsewhere that are really, really good at sequestering carbon and keeping the snow and ice around. So you can imagine the fir trees and other flora that rises up in the mammoth's absence is a lot darker than the grasslands that the woolly mammoths kept alive. They were kind of the keystone species of that particular ecosystem. So the idea is, oh, if we bring them back, they'll start knocking down those trees. They'll start recreating the mammoth steppe. They'll start refreezing the permafrost. And it will help us with a little problem that we like to call climate change.
So, right, because the thawing of the permafrost will release a lot of methane. Is that?
That is correct. Yeah. Essentially, it's unlocking all this stored plant material. Like in your freezer, you might have an old package of spinach or something. That carbon in that spinach is locked away because the microbes can't work on it. It's too cold. But when it warms up, when it thaws, then the microbes get to work and they produce methane, which of course is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And they also produce CO2, which is the primary greenhouse gas. And so it's a self-amplifying runaway effect of global warming.
All right. So I'm putting my money on the woolly mammoths returning.
Okay.
I think...
Probably to Pleistocene Park, which is sort of the epicenter for this. So there are these two crazy Russians who have set up an entire park dedicated to this concept. They would love to have mammoths, but of course mammoths don't currently exist. But what do exist are horses and wild cows and other kind of large larger animals anyway, bison, that can sort of replicate what mammoths were up to. And so they're undertaking this experiment to see if this is all true, right? Nobody can say for sure that bringing the mammoths back would have this effect. It's sort of a thought experiment at this stage. But by doing it with other animals, these folks, the Zimovs in Russia, are hoping to prove that, yes, this would work. And I should say that there is also another kind of side benefit of this work on the woolly mammoth. It's saving species that do still exist, developing the genetic technology that can help assist these plants and animals that are on the edge of extinction right now. So most famously, the rhinoceros, but also things like the black-footed ferret here in the United States. They were down to, I think it was 8 individual animals at one point, and essentially an entire population has been regrown. It's in the low hundreds, but still been regrown from those 8 individuals. As you can imagine, that means they don't have a lot of genetic diversity, and therefore they're more susceptible to things like disease and other problems that can affect animals without enough genetic diversity. So the idea is, oh, maybe we can take some of the genetic material from animals that have been kept in museum storage or in the permafrost, even frozen, and re-inject that using these same techniques into the living animal populations. And that will restore some of their vigor and allow them to survive and even thrive in the world we've made.
So that's really interesting, the idea of engineering genetic diversity. I think both of those examples, both this attempt to save endangered species and more fantastically, the idea of bringing back to life extinct species, they're both good emblems for the concept of your book, this idea of the unnatural world. By the unnatural world, my understanding is you don't mean the end of nature, it's not the artificial world, but rather the end of the idea that we can separate nature from the human sphere of influence. Does that sound right?
That is exactly right, and I'm so glad you got that from the book, because that's what I'm sort of trying to get across. We're well past the point, if there ever was a point, where humans and nature, however you want to define it, are separate. There isn't a part of the natural world that hasn't been touched by human influence at this point. Most of that has been unintended, with predictable kind of bad consequences. And so part of the argument I'm making is that we're having these impacts. We ought to take ownership of them and then try to do it better. So to make for a better unnatural world, if you will.
So a more conscious, deliberate, thoughtful, unnatural world. It's a really provocative idea in a way. So, you know, my podcast is on this intersection of culture and nature, the idea being that you can't separate science or what needs to happen from what informs us culturally. So there's a quote of yours. So you say, "The idea of nature as something apart has deep roots in Western philosophy, stretching perhaps all the way back to the Garden of Eden." So I wonder if you could speak on this a little bit and on the need to get people to understand that that's fundamentally a false distinction.
Yeah, I think that latter part is the most important part, kind of wrapping our heads around this idea that we're not apart from nature, and also that we're not necessarily bad. We have been bad, but we don't have to be bad. You can have a more intentional, profound relationship with the natural world once you understand that you are an integral part of it, and that kind of the culture-nature divide, or however you want to phrase that, is not really a thing. Humans would not be here without the air we breathe, the water we drink, and all the other things that the natural world provides. At the same time, the natural world is essentially been influenced by this one animal, many other animals as well. Sometimes I think the microbes are really running the show. But this one animal that has sort of started to have these world-spanning effects. So you can go to the remotest lake in the Amazon or deep onto the Antarctic ice shelf, and you will find evidence of what we've been up to. And by we, I mean the broadest definition of kind of the human family, whether that's soot from our incessant fossil fuel burning, or just the mix of plants and animals that now exist. There's even archaeological evidence that the Amazon rainforest was much more densely inhabited than many people once thought. It was once thought to be this kind of pristine primeval forest. And as indigenous people knew all along, and Western scientists are starting to find out, that was a very much a human-managed ecosystem in the same way that North America was. So when you think about kind of origin stories in the Garden of Eden, they tend to set us in opposition to some natural world. You know, Eve gets tempted by the serpent, eats the apple of knowledge, and God gets angry and kicks us out into the real world, and much hardship ensues. That story should be more about the curse of knowledge than some sort of artificial division between a pre-lapsarian perfect garden world where everything was just as it should be, and then humans come along and kind of wreck it through agriculture or whatever else, and more about a dawning recognition that we do need to have a kind of more intentional relationship with nature, and that we do need ever more knowledge so we can be good stewards of this amazing planet that is our only home. You know, Elon Musk and the billionaires' delusions of grandeur aside, even if we do make it to Mars and beyond, nothing is going to replace Earth, at least anytime in the conceivable future. So we better get it right here.
Yeah. I don't sympathize with the fantasy of living on Mars personally. I mean, I understand it works for some people, but I'm good.
Mars definitely wants, Earth wants you to live. Mars definitely wants to kill you. Like, everything on Mars is trying to kill you.
No. Yeah, not as pretty either.
No, exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about this notion of the Anthropocene. So I really enjoyed your chapter where you go into depth on it. So you have to look up the name of the geologist that you write about.
Jan Zalisevich.
That's right. Jan Zalisevich. So he chairs a committee that's in charge of determining whether this term should be sanctioned officially by the science of geology, which it has not yet at this point. And so that's sort of a kicking off point for you to talk about a number of things, including how would we date it? You know, when does the Anthropocene begin? Which is kind of a fun exercise because it allows you to explore so many different layers of human impact. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? And did you come up with a satisfactory answer for yourself as to when we would date the Anthropocene?
Sure. So first and foremost, I have to say that if there's a worse word than the phrase climate change, Anthropocene is it. Yet it's the term we have. So essentially what scientists mean by it is what I was saying earlier, that human impacts have become so large that we deserve our own mark in the geologic record. And the geologic record is essentially just the book of Earth's history as told by geologists. And this is why I sort of fell in love with geologists, because I realized that their whole gig is making up stories about rocks. So they look at the evidence in the rocks and they write a story about it. It's a very cultural pursuit. It's like being a writer. And so the idea is, gosh, just like the asteroid that ended the reign of the dinosaurs or many of the other huge earth-changing, earth-transforming events, the great oxygenation when photosynthetic microbes first arose and drove their ancestors who were sulfur lovers and oxygen was poisonous to them, drove them into hiding and sort of took over the earth. Well, humans have taken over the earth. And the question becomes, as you put it, when did humans take over the earth? And that's what Jan and his crew have set out to do as part of the Anthropocene working group. So there are those who argue that it's a very recent development. And this seems to be the way that Jan and the folks on that team are leaning, that human impacts really have accelerated in, say, the last 50 years or so, so much so that there are all kinds of different markers that could serve as this kind of turning point in the book of Earth's history, where we turn the page from the Holocene, which is the immediately preceding chapter, if you will, in Earth's history, to this new Anthropocene concept. So they seem to be leaning towards around the 1950s, and you might ask why. The primary reason why seems to be something that came around in the 1940s, that is nuclear weapons, the nuclear bomb. So when we started blowing up nuclear bombs, we started putting elements into the environment that had never existed in the environment before in all of Earth's billions of years of history. So thousands or even tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years from now, when somebody, whoever that might be, an alien or some human descendant, looks back at this time, they will suddenly see plutonium and all these other strange elements and isotopes. And they'll be like, what was going on back then? And therefore, they might say, oh, okay, so this is when the Anthropocene began. And that will be apparent in the rock record. But there are many geologists and others who argue that the Anthropocene is a lot older than that. Maybe it should be dated to the 1850s or thereabouts, when the Industrial Revolution really took off. Or maybe it should be dated to 10 to 12,000 years ago, when agriculture really began to transform the entire world. There's been a lot of recent archaeological and ecology research to show just how big of an impact our ancient ancestors had on the world through fire, controlled burning, through clearing land for agriculture, just through managing the Amazon rainforest so that one tree that produced a certain fruit that might be a staple of a human being's diet was more present than other trees that do not. So we've been having a long-term impact. So the Anthropocene could be very old, basically dated to the end of the last ice age, or as Jan and others have argued, it could be relatively recent and dated to the advent of nuclear weapons. My personal preference is for a kind of middle Anthropocene, if you will, that's tied to soot. Because most of the big transformations in Earth's history have to do with climate changes. So transitions from an ice age to a warm period, from snowball Earth to a hothouse, these big climate changes, they also tend to be lead to huge transformations in kind of the animals and plants that are around. And that could be because of an asteroid, as we talked about with the dinosaurs, or that could just be due to changes in Earth's climate that then make it very hard for a woolly mammoth to survive and relatively easy for a human being to survive, or whatever the case may be. So we have records of soot from a mass extinction event that took place 66 million years ago, if I'm remembering correctly the dates. And that soot has persisted in that book of Earth's history, that rock record, for 66 million years. We are creating equivalent soot through our incessant fossil fuel burning that is everywhere. The remotest reaches of Antarctica, those lakes in the Amazon I talked about, there's soot everywhere. So 66 million years from now, the odds are, whoever's looking in the rock record will see this soot, will know that somebody was burning a lot of fossil fuel. And so to me, that makes the most sense as a permanent record of our impact on the planet. And hopefully it'll be us around 66 million years from now. Probably not us exactly. Hopefully we'll have evolved somewhat by then. But I hold out hope that our species could persist for a very, very long time, because we have the opportunity with our smarts to do that if we choose to.
Okay, I think I know officially that you're an optimist now.
I like to say a stubborn optimist. I do definitely have some pessimistic tendencies. I mean, I've been an environmental reporter for several decades, and it's hard to not mourn all the things that we've already lost or that we've already sort of wrecked.
Well, and your book certainly doesn't pull its punches. I mean, there were parts where I really felt like I was falling off the cliff there.
Oh, no.
Even though, well, you know, do you know, parenthetically, do you know the geologist Marcia Bjornerud?
I do.
She's great. I've interviewed her a few times. And
oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And so I have one episode with her that I call The Earth Story. And I agree with you about this storytelling dimension of geologists that I really love as well.
Yeah. What I loved about her book is that thinking like a geologist, thinking in these vast stretches of time, and this is probably true for cosmologists as well, who are thinking in even vaster stretches of time, really kind of reorients your perspective from the micro cycles of Twitter and the news and whatever else to this longer centuries or even millennia timescale, where it's like, yes, I do want people to be around 66 million years from now. So how do we achieve that? Because you start to realize that, gosh, Earth's had a lot of history before us. We'll likely have a lot of history after us, should we be so foolish as to, you know, allow these problems to kind of fester and get rid of us. So we need to do what we can to help ourselves and all our fellow passengers on this little spaceship Earth kind of get into the future together.
Yeah. And I find it's a reminder, too, that all of the things we take for granted were once not the case, which in a way is useful, right? Because I think that humans have this desire to hold on to things. But I think geologists are good at reminding us that change happens whether we like it or not, you know?
That's right.
So we have choices to make in the type of change that will happen.
Exactly. The only constant is change, right? That is the one thing you can sort of take for granted.
Yeah.
That change is coming one way or the other.
So there were so many evocative phrases in your book, but here's one. You say, combine the decisions taken in hotel world and the decisions taken in hovel world, and you have the Anthropocene. So describe for us what you mean by hotel world and hovel world and why those are,
I love that you picked out that sentence, and it's always incredibly flattering as a writer to hear someone describe your work as evocative. So thank you for that. So hotel world for me is a shorthand for this kind of supranational elite that is kind of going around making big decisions. This is sort of the top-down climate change approach that you'll be familiar with from international negotiations, one of which is going on shortly. And I call it hotel world because essentially people are moving, including myself, from one sort of air-conditioned bubble, for lack of a better term, to another. And you could be in London or Lagos or Los Angeles, and your experience is largely the same. You're insulated from any of the conditions of climate change. You don't really know where your coffee is coming from. And this kind of privilege is what I call hotel world. And that's where a lot of governments dwell, and these managerial decisions are made. Then by hovel world, I'm talking about the great majority of people on the planet who still are not living in the most modern iteration of human culture. So they don't have access to modern energy. They're still burning wood or animal dung. They don't have any protection from air pollution or health threats, modern healthcare. They are still trapped in subsistence farming, which of course, farming is the biggest impact that people have on the planet. So when you take the numbers, the billions of people who are still just trying to survive, and you pair that with the tens of thousands who are living in hotel world, that's how you end up with something like the Anthropocene, which is this sort of unmanaged mess. It's the world we live in now. And my argument is that we need to get better at managing it, because we can either do it unconsciously, or we can do it consciously. One way or the other, it's happening.
Well, I think this idea, particularly of the hotel, because, you know, I think it's fair to say that the majority of people in the United States live in a version of hotel world, whether it's a fancy hotel or a less fancy version of it. It really sort of gives you a sense of how our perspective on the world is framed and really kind of muffled and mediated in so many different ways, and
That's
how
right.
that plays a role also in what we can do going forward. And one piece of that is consumerism, which is another thing that you write about. You write, consumption is the real challenge, the real thing that needs to change. So that's something I confess, as an American, I feel some despair about, because
sure.
our capitalist culture is so much built on the idea of consumption.
That we all think of ourselves as consumers, because that's sort of how we've been trained to think about ourselves. You're putting your finger on another huge difference between hotel world and hovel world. It's just access to stuff. So, you know, a pet in the United States eats better than a poor person in Bangladesh. They have access to more calories, better quality food, and what have you. That is a kind of profound inequality that's sort of hard to wrap your head around. And that kind of injustice is what one would hope a better Anthropocene would start to ameliorate. So at the same time that we have to reduce the excesses of consumption in the American lifestyle, or replace let's say, bad consumption with better consumption, we also have to bring up the consumption of these large numbers of people who are dying for want of access to clean drinking water or adequate energy to support, I don't know, a life-saving piece of medical equipment. It is a tragedy that we have allowed ourselves to create that kind of inequality. And so that's why, for me, consumption is the core of the challenge. If you just look at flying's contribution to climate change, 2% of the problem from a very small subset of people. So when some pundits and others try to say, oh, it's population, it's really not. It's not the number of people. It's our habits as consumers, how we consume. That's the core of our mismanagement problem. And it's very easy to be divorced from the consequences of your choices when you're living in hotel world, right? Like I said, you don't know where your coffee's coming from. And you don't know where it's going after you've drunk it. Where are those coffee grounds going? You have no idea. Meat is packaged in these lovely little sanitary boxes with plastic, and it's completely divorced from the reality of a cow, chicken, or pig who, you know, had to give its life so you could eat that meat.
I wonder about education in that, you know, piece of it. If school children had to go to a slaughterhouse and see what was involved in the meat that they eat, you know, if they went to water treatment plants and recycling plants and sewage treatment plants and things like that. I mean, I say children, you could say the same for adults, because yeah, most adults haven't been exposed to those things either. But I wonder if, you know, education couldn't play an important role there to kind of break down some of those barriers between what we consume and the production process.
I completely agree with that. And I am exactly the kind of weirdo who loves going to a sewage treatment plant and seeing for myself the hidden infrastructure of the modern world, right? That sewage treatment plant is essentially saving millions of lives downstream from the diseases that might be born in your sewage. That's exactly what folks in less affluent parts of the world don't have access to, and therefore are getting sick from these kind of sewage-borne diseases. So that's kind of a miracle of modern technology. And I think we ignore it at our peril, because there are a lot of great lessons to be learned from that. And having a more intimate relationship with where our food comes from and what actually happens to sustain our lives. Where does electricity come from, right? For most people, it's, oh, I just flip the switch and the lights go on. It's not so much, oh, there's a coal-fired power plant way, you know, far away that's belching pollution into the sky and, you know, making these huge mounds of toxic coal ash. But if you become more intimate with the support systems of human life, first, you can see what a miracle they are, how much they have enhanced our lives, and how that should be accessible to everyone. And then also, gosh, here are the huge problems associated with that. So maybe we shouldn't be burning fossilized sunshine. We should just take advantage of all the fresh stuff that's pouring down on our heads every day.
Yeah. That sounds good to me. So if the poor suffer disproportionately, at the same time, they have things to teach us in terms of not having this culture of just endless consumption. At one point, you talk about how it doesn't matter what culture you go to. You know, if you go to, I think of the rag pickers in Dickens for some reason. That's
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Hopelessly European references, but certain economies, because they just don't have the means, can't bear to have this sort of disposable thing. So I imagine you've thought about how there are lessons that can be drawn as well from not just new technologies, but sometimes also older ways of reusing things.
That's exactly right. There's this concept, it's called thrift. I think our grandparents were extremely familiar with it. If you talk to folks who lived through the Great Depression in the United States, there is a sort of abhorrence of our throwaway culture, right? Why wouldn't you repair your sewing machine? Why wouldn't you reuse that aluminum can or whatever it might be? Now, we have been kind of educated, as you mentioned, away from that so that we would be involved in this culture of planned obsolescence and, gosh, just buy a new one. Don't worry about fixing the old one. That is not the case for folks who are living in less affluent circumstances. And that's sort of what we should aim to bring back, I would argue. I like this idea of heirloom objects. So rather than using a new iPhone every couple of years because there's so many new features and the voice audio recording is so much better or the camera is so much better, what about a more modular iPhone where you could upgrade your camera by just inserting that into this heirloom gadget? Now, that is a very different economy than the one that we live in, but it is also very close to the economy of the majority of people around the world. And, you know, it seems like a pretty good one. And we lost that at our peril.
Absolutely.
I should add to that that that's also how the natural world works. The waste of one animal becomes the food of another. Essentially, the natural world runs on sunshine, fresh sunshine. So plants have figured out this amazing trick. Take the constituents of air, particularly carbon dioxide, mix it with water, using the power of the sunlight that's pouring in, and make food and more plants. And the whole world runs on that ecosystem. And honestly, our climate change problem is a result of plants being so good at that that they created all this fossil sunshine, so coal, oil, and natural gas. It's really just stored sunshine from the billions of years of Earth's history. And it's great. We're burning through it at a record pace. The problem is we're liberating all that CO2 that the plants work so hard to lock away. And so if we could learn a trick from the plants and just get on to the sunshine economy, we'd be better off. And also sort of adopting that circular approach of the waste of one process becomes the feedstock of another, and so on, essentially infinitely. That's real sustainability.
How's the technology on solar energy? Is it getting more sophisticated?
It's definitely getting more sophisticated. You know, sometimes I feel like the folks who bought solar panels 10 years ago feel a little jealous of the folks who are buying solar panels right now because they have advanced so much in terms of efficiency and the amount of electricity produced. The grid, this huge, really continent-spanning machine that we built to shuttle electricity around, is now much better suited to cope with your solar panels on your house. What I think is interesting about the sunshine economy is it starts to scramble some of our cultural divides as well. So you could put solar panels on your house because you're concerned about climate change and you want to do your part to fight it. In that case, I would call you a liberal, and it's great. You could put solar panels on your roof because you want to be out from under the thumb of your electric utility and have energy independence. In that case, I'd probably call you a libertarian. And you may not care about climate change, but it doesn't matter. You're still doing your part to combat it.
Yeah. So continuing with this idea of sustainability, you talk about the idea of a circular economy. And in particular, you talk about the city of, is it Rizhao in China, where they have the ambition to create a kind of circular economy. And then you talk about this marsh gas in particular. Tell us what the deal is there.
So
it's pretty wild.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. You're really getting deep into my book, and I love it. So Rizhao is a very interesting place because they are sort of an experiment, really within all of Chinese society, to see if a circular economy might be possible for CO2 and for everything else. It's a resort town as well as having some manufacturing. So in a sense, if it works in Rizhao, it might spread to other parts of China just from folks, you know, going there for a beachside vacation and being like, wow, you know, I want solar panels on my house. If they can do it here, why can't I do it back home? And so they are undertaking all these experiments in how to make for a truly sustainable kind of circular economy. And one of them is marsh gas. So this is what happens to your garbage as it's festering in a landfill. Microbes, again, the hidden masters of the world, are busy breaking down all the edible stuff in your garbage, especially organic matter. As a result of that, they release a lot of methane. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's also the primary component in what most of us call natural gas, I like to call it fossil gas because, you know, natural is probably the wrong word to use associated with that. It's fossil gas. And marsh gas is much more natural gas, quite honestly, because it's freshly produced from your garbage. So you can harvest that. It's actually sort of a renewable energy resource, and then use that to power some of the industry that happens in Rizhao and have kind of this manufacturing economy. And their idea, which has really been adopted at the global level now in climate negotiations, is to try to get to carbon neutrality. You sometimes hear of it called net zero. This is the idea that no more carbon goes into the atmosphere than you're taking out of it. And that's great. But Rizhao has already run into a huge problem, which is essentially a lot of the manufacturing concerns were like, it's great that you're going to try to be carbon neutral within the city boundaries. We're going to move just past the city boundaries and keep doing what we were doing all along, which is polluting and whatever else. So they're sort of fleeing from the carbon neutrality concept, which gets back to the point that global warming is a global problem. You're going to see a lot of that kind of flight. That's essentially what happened in the US. A lot of our most polluting industries moved to China when we started having stronger environmental rules. And that's why you need global solutions to this net zero conundrum. So there is really no place to run away to. In the same way that there really is no away when you're throwing things away, there shouldn't be any artificial boundary between, okay, we're going to be clean here in hotel world, but then on the other side of this artificial boundary, you can do what you like. You can pollute as much as you want or whatever else. A molecule of greenhouse gas, it doesn't matter where it came from. It has the same warming effect in the atmosphere. So we really have to get global in our management. So it's beautiful what Rizhao is attempting. And now it just needs to spread further and further so that folks can't run away from it.
I wanted to ask you about carbon sequestering, because you have this one chapter about Viktor Smedicek. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Well done.
I got one right. 1 point for me. And his experiments to sequester carbon by, you call it fertilizing the ocean.
That's right.
So I was interested in that and just in carbon sequestration in general, because it seems like that's probably going to have to be a piece of the puzzle.
It definitely is, because I think some of the despair comes from the fact that it's pretty apparent that we've already gone too far. There's too much carbon dioxide up there in the atmosphere. We're already seeing worse fires and floods and other extreme weather. And we haven't even gotten more than a degree of global warming. And we're on course to more like 2 or even 3 degrees of global warming. So, you know, we don't want to get there. And one of the ways to not get there is to pull some of that fossil CO2, right, that we liberated when we burned that coal, oil, and fossil gas back out of the atmosphere. Now, there already exists an absolutely fantastic technology for this. I mentioned it earlier. They're called plants. They have a magic trick that we really haven't bettered with all of our wonders of technology, of pulling CO2 out of the air, right? Using sunshine and water and building these complex molecules. Human chemists have nothing on a leaf, I'm here to tell you.
Yeah, another person I've interviewed several times is Doug Tallamy. Do you know him? So his recent book is on oaks. So he suggests that we should all plant oaks because they're not only the biggest feeders of insects and thus of lots of other creatures, but also are great at sequestering carbon.
Exactly. So all different types of plants have figured out how to do this. And again, like I said, you know, it's all that amazing photosynthesis that has resulted in that coal, oil, and fossil gas. That's coming from buried plant matter. So Viktor's idea is to harness that. And really what he's trying to do is replace, if you'll pardon the potty humor, whale poop. So essentially, before we hunted whales almost to extinction, there were vast herds, and they were kind of wandering around eating the krill and other tiny creatures of the sea and pooping. And in their poop was iron. And this is the missing ingredient in photosynthesis in the oceans of the world. That's the limiting element. So in the same way you're working in your garden and you might want to add some nitrogen fertilizer or some phosphorus or maybe some calcium, something that's missing in your local soil. In the oceans, the missing ingredient is iron. And in fact, the scientist who discovered this used to say, give me enough iron and I'll give you an ice age. Because if you put enough iron out there, the tiny plants of the sea, they're called phytoplankton, will draw enough CO2 out of the air that many scientists believe that's how ice ages begin, that they bury so much carbon that the levels drop in the atmosphere, and therefore we don't have enough global warming. And suddenly there are vast ice sheets over North America. So Victor wanted to try this out. So he set out with some iron fertilizer down to the Southern Ocean. That's the ocean that surrounds Antarctica. That also happens to be where a lot of the whales used to be and still are, but even more back then. But he also set out because they have these interesting ocean phenomenon called eddies. So you could have a kind of enclosed, just by natural currents, area of ocean, right? Otherwise, the iron sort of disperses. And so he wanted the ocean equivalent of a field, a test field. So they fertilized this ocean eddy, and lo and behold, there was a phytoplankton bloom, and they measured how much of that plankton went all the way down to the seafloor, where it's essentially sequestered, where it's buried far away from the atmosphere for thousands or even longer periods of time. Because there was a thought, oh, well, yeah, you have a plankton bloom, but guess what? Animals end up eating it, and the CO2 eventually just ends up back in the atmosphere. And they measured a significant fraction of that CO2 getting all the way down to the seafloor and therefore kind of being sequestered on geologic timescales, so millennia and beyond. So that's good news, right? We can bring the whales back and potentially fertilize the oceans in this way. We might solve a significant chunk of our climate change problem. And that's just one kind of carbon sequestering idea. Obviously, planting oaks is another. Planting trees, planting shrubbery, if you will, vegetation of all kinds is a good thing. But the amount of CO2 that's up there, we need to go well beyond those sort of natural solutions if we're really going to put all that fossil carbon back where it belongs, probably deep underground. We're going to need the power of geology. And geology works through weathering. So rain kind of breaks up the rocks, and those rocks actually absorb CO2. This is how Earth's climate changes over geologic time, this weathering aspect. Unfortunately for us, that takes hundreds of thousands of years to make a significant difference. So what we can do is sort of accelerate that in a very natural process. So if we ground up the rock and spread it on farm fields, not only would we improve the soil health, we would also be sequestering carbon. And there are many, I guess I would call them hybrid solutions like that, where you're harnessing the power of nature, but perhaps accelerating it to human relevant timescales. That's how we're going to kind of solve the carbon sequestering challenge, which is the big challenge of climate change. How are we going to draw that fossil CO2 back out of the air that we're all breathing, because that's what we have to do now.
So you think it's possible?
It's definitely possible. It's just a matter of scale and desire. So we need, on the one hand, the money to do it. And on the other hand, and this is the true missing ingredient, because there's plenty of money in the world, the political will to do it. Instead of fighting over whether climate change is real or who's to blame, we should be fighting over who gets to host these rock weathering operations. I mean, I originally come from Missouri in the Midwest, and putting that kind of ground up basalt on the soils of the Midwest would actually be a huge benefit to the farmers there. So we should be fighting over who gets to host these things, not over whether we should do them.
That's really interesting. Before you go, can you give my listeners one idea of something that they could do to help them feel a bit empowered? Because I know all of this can seem quite, well, is quite overwhelming.
It is quite overwhelming. I would say the number one thing you can do is talk about it. I think a lot of us are afraid to talk about climate change because it is such a divisive subject here in the United States. And you don't want to, I don't know, get into a fight with your uncle or aunt at the Thanksgiving table. But presuming it's not going to become a violent altercation, talking about it is a great way for us to move forward. And talking about it in a way that, like the example of solar panels, can appeal to both liberals and conservatives. I would also say that getting your hands dirty in a garden is a great way to feel that you're having an impact on climate change. Growing those plants, you are often sequestering carbon. Improving your soil is also going to sequester carbon. You'll be doing your small part to pull some of that fossil CO2 back out of the sky and lock it away in your soils. There are great soil amendments for that, whether it's the ground up rocks or biochar, which is essentially plant material that enriches your soil as well as kind of makes a great home for the microbes that are going to make the nutrients for your plants, so you don't have to apply as much nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer. And you can have this sort of wonderful, natural, unnatural hybrid garden thing going on. And that's really what we should all be striving for, this kind of comfort in what I'm calling the unnatural world, but is really just the world. It's always been that way. And this kind of natural, unnatural divide is a mental construct that's holding us back in some ways. It's all natural, it's all unnatural, and we just need to be better stewards, better caretakers of our local environment and of this beautiful planet we call Earth.
Hope you enjoyed this interview. I know I'll take a lot away from it, starting with David's simple injunction just to talk more about climate change. Going forward, I have a number of exciting interviews to share with you. We'll look at forests and climate change with forestry ecologist Andrew Reinman and with Meg Lohman, also known as Canopy Meg, and discuss the role of art in addressing climate change with Ed Morris and Susanna Saylor, creators of the Canary Project.